285, Chapter 14 of Jane Eyre. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 286, Let It Snow, Please. This episode brought to you by Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com. And links to all of our sponsors can be found in the sidebar of the show notes at craftlit.com. Please visit them, as their support for the show is one of the things that keeps it free for you. Well, we continue not to have snow. We have snow all around us. There's snow to the north. There is right now snowing to the south, but there is no snowing here. My children are like unto mutineers. They are so unhappy about this situation. And, you know, two gray winters with no snow in a row? I can't complain. We at least have temperatures, right? Which we didn't always have in Arizona. In fact, Arizona, Tucson, has been colder this winter of late than Virginia. Ah, yes. Weather. If you are interested, my dad is friends with a climatologist who just came out with a big governmental report. She's one of the people involved. And I have a link to that in the show notes if you want to read something that isn't media laden about this. And in other news, I need to tell you, I finally found decent audio, and I have chosen the next subscriber book. And it's a big departure for us from what we've been doing. We are going to do a comedy. We are going to do a pointed comedy, but a comedy nonetheless. It is called The Canterville Ghost. It is by Oscar Wilde. It's not terribly long, but it's fun. And the thing that made me really excited about it, there's a Canadian-British joint venture. They are making an animated feature, and two of the voices that will be in it are Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. So you'll get to hear the story, the real story, the whole story, on the subscriber feed, if you are a subscriber. And then later this year? I think it's Christmas 2013 it's coming out? Or was it late 2014? Because it's animated. That always takes a long time. Anyway, you'll know the story long before they make the movie. I missed it with Les Mis, but I've got it with Canterville Ghost. So if you have the Craftlit iPhone app and you suddenly decide, hey, I want access to this subscriber audio, all you have to do is tap a little lockbox icon that you'll see and sign up. And it's a monthly subscription. $5 a month gets you access to all of the content, streamable. And then when books are complete, we'll let you know, and you can download that audio. So if you listen on an MP3 player or an older model iPod, you'll be able to download it to your device that way. You can cancel whenever. Whenever you do cancel, everything goes back to being locked. And that's the way it's working. It's finally working, so I'm very happy. And in fact, right now there is a subscriber PDF. It is working now. It has all the links you need for downloading your MP3 audiobook copy of Cool for Cats and Wuthering Heights as complete audiobooks. And that's it. I will announce from here on out when there's a PDF for you to go grab. And I'll mention when new subscriber audio is up. But now I think everything's set and we don't have to go through the crazy anymore, which is great. If you are in or around New York City this weekend, you can go to Vogue Knitting Live at 1:30 on Saturday. Go to the Bijou Basin booth and see Alistair Post-Quinn, who will be there to sign books and show off the samples of his unbelievably gorgeous double knit stuff. So that is a fun destination for you for this weekend. He'll be there, what is it, the 19th of January 2013. So, Jane Eyre. Well, as you can tell with the build that we've been going through over the last couple of episodes with Jane Eyre, once Rochester shows up, the book changes somewhat. We had kind of the deprivation of her childhood, and then we had, you know, the school, which was just and now I kind of, when I've been thinking about it, you know, I worked on the film Aladdin, and it's moments like this where you just kind of go, a whole new world. And it's it's so sad, because the day that they brought that song in, I was there and I thought, really? That's it? That's the love song? Oh, dear. There had been another love song that they had had before that, which I liked better, but clearly there is a reason why I am not directing animation. I would have really failed that test. But it is for Jane. It is a whole new world. She even says stuff to that effect in the next couple, over the next couple of chapters. So Jane's in this great new situation. She is speaking to a man, which for her is huge, because who are the men she's had in her life? None, except the horrible, horrible headmaster at her school. So she's never really had this thing happen. Well, not surprisingly, Charlotte's life really took a turn for the interesting when a man showed up. And this is not a really well-known part of Charlotte's history. It was, I think it's kind of hinted at in Elizabeth Gaskell's book, but it's really, it had been kind of expunged from the records, because when this Elizabeth Gaskell biography of Charlotte Bronte was released, almost immediately after Charlotte's death, within a year and a half of her death, people were still alive who were involved. And so Gaskell had to do some pretty fancy footwork with figuring out what could be said, what should be said, what needed to be said. And I think she didn't always make the right decisions, but it's hard to fault her for that, because she wasn't a biographer. And I don't think there were really any kind of rules, and I'm putting air quotes around that, you know, rules about how to go about writing a biography of the recently deceased. And I think under the best of circumstances, that's an incredibly, extraordinarily difficult challenge to do well. So what happened, or as my students would have said, well, what happened was, and I mentioned this in passing before, Charlotte decides in her late 20s that she and Emily need to go to Brussels. They need to get a continental education if they are going to open their own school. So they wrangle the money, they beg, borrow, and steal, they do everything they can, they get themselves to Brussels. They are the only two poor-ish, English-speaking, not much at all French-speaking students at the school. There are other English-speaking people, but those other English speakers speak much better French. So Charlotte and Emily are really isolated, and they know that they aren't going to be there for more than a year. And the headmaster and his wife also know this. And taking their job very seriously, and understanding that these two much older students, they were like 26 and 29, or 20, 24 and 27, it was something like that, mid to late 20s. These are young women who are older than the rest of the students, who are there specifically to prepare themselves to set up their own school. And so the headmaster really takes them under his wing, and he focuses lots of attention on them. And specifically, the kind of attention he focuses on them surrounds writing. Now, it's hard to tell, because he didn't keep a journal or a diary. At least he didn't leave one extant when he died. But it's hard to tell if he did this because he recognized that they had a talent to begin with, or if he discovered this talent as they went along, because eventually he did see something in both Charlotte and Emily. And his techniques that he used were, in some cases, kind of radical, as far as trying to get them to write in French, write cogently in French, write argument in French, write fiction in French, think in French. I mean, he really tried to give them this extraordinary education in a very short period of time. Well, if you are a bookish, nerdy girl who has been described by everyone on the planet as very tiny, very frail, but very plain, and you show up on the continent and you are surrounded by gorgeous, old, you know, interesting city stuff, but you are largely isolated because you don't really speak the language very well and you don't have a whole lot of time to go out and explore. And instead, you're given this kind of awe-inspiring intellect to learn from every day. I mean, your personal intellectual guide to a larger world. It doesn't take long for you to figure out that one of them, if not both of them, is going to form some kind of an attachment to this man, regardless of the fact that he's married. I'll give you a hint. It wasn't Emily. Emily routinely wrote in her notebooks and things that are still extant, things that were saved. She's like, this is stupid. I can't believe we're doing this. And I'm not joking. I mean, she really, I can't believe how completely lame this is. This is just ridiculous. This is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. So that was kind of Emily's take on it. She was less happy being there than Charlotte was. Charlotte, however, kind of formed an inappropriate attachment to her tutor. And it was very interesting because she wound up in some letters to her friends, at least sounding like she was blaming the wife. Like, I don't understand why this woman doesn't like me. She's so cold. She's so frigid. She never invites me anywhere. Blah, 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 blah. Which is not true. In fact, there are letters extant from the wife saying, we hope that you join us at tea. We hope that you please understand that because you're an older student instead of you're not a regular student, that this sitting room is always available to you. I mean, really generous stuff. And Charlotte just was completely blind to it because she was so enamored of the headmaster. Well, for her, like Jane, this was really the first man who she'd ever had any kind of adult relationship with. Because prior to this, it had been her father, her immediately younger to her brother Branwell, and then the headmasters at her schools who were not much better than Mr. Brocklehurst. So she has this. Nobody really knows if it was an affair, quote unquote, affair with all of the implications that are tied up in that, or if it was one of those affairs of the mind. But, you know, I mean, you can have a deeply inappropriate relationship with someone that does not include touching. You know, if you're married to someone else and you have this really emotional email relationship with someone, that can totally affect your marriage. Even though you're not touching the third party physically, your emotional connection to them can really futz with your ability to work through whatever you need to work through in your marriage. Well, this is kind of what seemed to be happening with Charlotte and the headmaster. And it got kind of tense and it was, I guess they were there. They wound up being able to stay for a year and a half, almost 2 years. And I'm sure by the time they left, the wife was really glad. But Charlotte and the headmaster continued to write letters to each other more or less for the rest of their life. And it's interesting because this relationship that she had with him kind of eventually, when she finally started publishing her books, this kind of almost flirty, lighthearted, affectionate relationship wound up happening with her publisher as well. There were two gentlemen out of three who worked at the publishing house that she had contracted with, and she wound up having these same kinds of flirty, really is the right word, relationships with these guys. And the mother of one of them did start to get a little nervous because when she went down to London, she stayed with the family, and she clearly really dug this one guy, and he really couldn't marry her for all of the many layers of complicated class financial stuff that we know was so prevalent in the 1700s, 1800s in England. So Charlotte is drawing on some really interesting personal stuff when she's in these opening chapters with Rochester. When she talks about the awkwardness of being an employee, the governess, but not a servant. It's not like she's, you know, a lady's maid. She's a governess, so she has to have all the manners and education of a lady, but she doesn't have the social position of a lady. So she's in this awkward twilight zone, and Rochester clearly is kind of okay with that, but as the head of household, he's allowed to be okay with that. That's the way it is. And he doesn't have anybody else to talk to, and so this is great for him. And in fact, Charlotte, when she was even younger and worked as a governess, she always had, I think I mentioned this before, a good relationship with the fathers, and eventually it would always kind of decay into kind of a lousy relationship with the mothers. Although the mothers were never able to figure out exactly what had gone wrong. I think Charlotte Bronte's intellect was always of the sharper nature. And I've actually come away from the biography of her feeling like she was just more comfortable talking with men. Not that she didn't have female friends, and not that she wasn't a lady, and all of the, you know, she learned her P's and Q's. She knew what she was supposed to do. She knew how to behave herself, mostly. She had a sharp tongue. But intellectually, she seems to have been so much more comfortable with men. And you see some of that come across in Jane's character. Now, a couple of things happen in this chapter that the movies consistently flub. And I think the movies flub it because they don't think we'll buy it if it's in the film. It's one of those things like in 1776, when the writers of the musical 1776 had the opportunity to put in the line where John Adams said, and he said this in writing in a letter, "If we don't solve the slave problem now, it will destroy the country within 50 years. And they're like, well, we can't put that in because nobody will believe that he said it. No one's going to believe he predicted the Civil War. And you're like, well, yep, that's probably true. That's probably a good move. And I think the movie makers have had that same kind of reaction to certain scenes in Jane Eyre. And you'll hear there's more than one where the every movie version that I've seen has changed some very specific actions of Jane's that are in the book. And so we'll talk about some of those on the flip side today. But today's chapter is one of the exciting ones. And this is one of the gothic ones. And this is one of the ones where you can really start to see all of that kind of creepy, gothic, turgid, morbid, melancholy, melodramatic writing that Charlotte did with Branwell when they were children, and now it starts to get drawn upon and pulled out, and it works in the book. It makes sense in the book. It feels right in the book. But when you take a step back and look at it as puzzle pieces, it's kind of surprising that it does work, because you go, okay, well, it starts off as a Dickensian David Copperfield Great Expectations, oh, I had a hard childhood. And then it moves into, and then I had a harder childhood and my best friend died of TB. And then all of a sudden it's, and now I'm happy and I'm a governess and I have this cute little girl that I'm in charge of in a beautiful old house. And I have a boss who treats me well and who I get along with.
And then the creepy creepiness begins.
And you're like, well, how does that fit together? But it does. It does, and it works really, really well. And so today's chapter is a lot of fun. So I'm going to talk to you more about some of the details on the flip side. But now I am going to start playing for you Chapter 15 of Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte.
Mr. Rochester did, on a future occasion, explain it. It was one afternoon when he chanced to meet me and Adele in the grounds, and while she played with Pilot and her shuttlecock, he asked me to walk up and down a long beech avenue within sight of her. He then said that she was the daughter of a French opera dancer, Céline Varenne, towards whom he had once cherished what he called a grand passion. This passion Céline had professed to return with even superior ardour. He thought himself her idol, ugly as he was. He believed, as he said, that she preferred his taille d'athlète to the elegance of the Apollo Belvedere. And so, Monsieur, so much was I flattered by this preference of the Gallic sylph for her British gnome, that I installed her in hotel. I gave her a complete establishment of servants, a carriage, cashmeres, diamonds, dentelle, etc. In short, I began the process of ruining myself in the received style, like any other spoonie. I had not, it seemed, the originality to chalk out a new road to shame and destruction, but trod the old track with stupid exactness not to deviate an inch from the beaten centre. I had, as I deserved to have, the fate of all other spoonies. Happening to call one evening when Céline did not expect me, I found her out. But it was a warm night, and I was tired with strolling through Paris, so I sat down in her boudoir, happy to breathe the air consecrated so lately by her presence. No, I exaggerate. I never thought that there was any consecrating virtue about her. It was rather a sort of pastille perfume she had left, a scent of musk and amber than an odour of sanctity. I was just beginning to stifle with the fumes of conservatory flowers and sprinkled essences, when I bethought myself to open the window and step out onto the balcony. It was moonlight and gaslight besides, and very still and serene. The balcony was furnished with a chair or two. I sat down and took out a cigar. I will take one now, if you will excuse me. Here ensued a pause, filled up by the producing and lighting of a cigar. Having placed it to his lips and breathed a trail of Havana incense on the freezing and sunless air, he went on. I liked bonbons, too, in those days, Miss Eyre, and I was croquant, overlook the barbarism, croquant chocolat confit, and smoking alternately, and watching meantime the equipage that rolled along the fashionable streets toward the neighbouring opera house, when in an elegant close carriage drawn by a beautiful pair of English horses, and distinctly seen in the brilliant city night, I recognised the voiture I had given Céline. She was returning. Of course my heart thumped with impatience against the iron rails I leant upon. The carriage stopped, as I had expected, at the hotel door. My flame, that is the very word for an opera inamorata, alighted. Though muffled in a cloak, an unnecessary encumbrance, by the by, on so warm a June evening, I knew her instantly by her little foot, seen peeping from the skirt of her dress as she skipped from the carriage step. Bending over the balcony, I was about to murmur, "Mon ange," in a tone, of course, which should be audible to the ear of love alone, when a figure jumped from the carriage after her, cloaked also. But that was a spurred heel which had rung on the pavement, and that was a hatted head which now passed under the arched porte-cochere of the hotel. You never felt jealousy, did you, Miss Eyre? Of course not. I need not ask you, because you have never felt love. You have both sentiments yet to experience. Your soul sleeps. The shock is yet to be given which shall waken it. You think all existence lapses in as quiet a flow as that in which your youth has hitherto slid away. Floating on with closed eyes and muffled ears, you neither see the rocks bristling not far off in the bed of the flood, nor hear the breakers boil at their base. But I tell you, and you may mark my words, you will come some day to a craggy pass in the channel, where the whole of life's stream will be broken up into whirl and tumult, foam and noise. Either you will be dashed to atoms on crag points, or lifted up and borne on by some master wave into a calmer current, as I am now. I like this day. I like that sky of steel. I like the sternness and stillness of the world under this frost. I like Thornfield, its antiquity, its retirement, its old crow trees and thorn trees, its grey facade and lines of dark windows reflecting that metal welkin. And yet how long have I abhorred the very thought of it, shunned it like a great plague-house? How do I still abhor? He ground his teeth and was silent. He arrested his step and struck his boot against the hard ground. Some hated thought seemed to have him in its grip, and to hold him so tightly that he could not advance. We were ascending the avenue when he thus paused. The hall was before us. Lifting his eye to its battlements, he cast over them a glare such as I never saw before or since. Pain, shame, ire, impatience, disgust, detestation seemed momentarily to hold a quivering conflict in the large pupil dilating under his ebon eyebrow. Wild was the wrestle which should be paramount, but another feeling rose and triumphed. Something hard and cynical, self-willed and resolute. It settled his passion and petrified his countenance. He went on. "During the moment I was silent, Messer, I was arranging a point with my destiny. She stood there by that beech trunk, a hag like one of those who appeared to Macbeth on the heath of Forres. "You like Thornfield?" she said, lifting her finger. And then she wrote in the air a memento, which ran in lurid hieroglyphics all along the house front, between the upper and lower row of windows. "Like it if you can. Like it if you dare." "I will like it," said I. "I dare like it. And," he subjoined moodily, "I will keep my word. I will break obstacles to happiness, to goodness, yes, goodness. I wish to be a better man than I have been, than I am. As Job's Leviathan broke the spear, the dart, and the habergeon, hindrances which others count as iron and brass, I will esteem but straw and rotten wood." Adèle here ran before him with her shuttlecock. "Away," he cried harshly. "Keep at a distance, child, or go in to Sophie." Continuing then to pursue his walk in silence, I ventured to recall him to the point where he had abruptly diverged. "Did you leave the balcony, sir?" I asked, "when Mademoiselle Varenne entered?" I almost expected a rebuff for this hardly well-timed question, but on the contrary, waking out of his scowling abstraction, he turned his eyes towards me, and the shade seemed to clear off his brow. "Oh, I had forgotten Celine. Well, to resume. When I saw my charmer thus come in accompanied by a cavalier, I seemed to hear a hiss, and the green snake of jealousy rising on undulating coils from the moonlit balcony glided within my waistcoat and ate its way in 2 minutes to my heart's core. Strange," he exclaimed, suddenly starting again from the point. "Strange that I should choose you for the confidant of all this, young lady. Passing strange that you should listen to me quietly, as if it were the most usual thing in the world for a man like me to tell stories of his opera mistress to a quaint, inexperienced girl like you. But the last singularity explains the first, as I intimated once before. You, with your gravity, considerateness, and caution, were made to be the recipient of secrets. Besides, I know what sort of a mind I have placed in communication with my own. I know it is one not liable to take infection. It is a peculiar mind. It is a unique one. Happily, I do not mean to harm it. But if I did, it would not take harm from me. The more you and I converse, the better. For while I cannot blight you, you may refresh me." After this digression, he proceeded. "I remained in the balcony. They will come to her boudoir, no doubt," thought I. "Let me prepare an ambush." So putting my hand in through the open window, I drew the curtain over it, leaving only an opening through which I could take observations. Then I closed the casement, all but a chink just wide enough to furnish an outlet to lovers' whispered vows. Then I stole back to my chair, and as I resumed it, the pair came in. My eye was quickly at the aperture. Celine's chambermaid entered, lit a lamp, left it on the table, and withdrew. The couple were thus revealed to me clearly. Both removed their cloaks, and there was the Varenne, shining in satin and jewels, my gifts, of course, and there was her companion in an officer's uniform, and I knew him for a young roué of a vicomte, a brainless and vicious youth whom I had sometimes met in society, and had never thought of hating because I despised him so absolutely. On recognizing him, the fang of the snake jealousy was instantly broken, because at the same moment my love for Celine sank under an extinguisher. A woman who could betray me for such a rival was not worth contending for. She deserved only scorn. Less, however, than I, who had been her dupe. They began to talk. Their conversation eased me completely. Frivolous, mercenary, heartless, and senseless, it was rather calculated to weary than enrage a listener. A card of mine lay on the table. This, being perceived, brought my name under discussion. Neither of them possessed an energy or wit to belabour me soundly, but they insulted me as coarsely as they could in their little way, especially Celine, who even waxed rather brilliant on my personal defects, deformities, she termed them. Now it had been her custom to launch out into fervent admiration of what she called my beauté mâle, wherein she differed diametrically from you, who told me point-blank at the second interview that you did not think me handsome. The contrast struck me at the time, and— Adèle here came running up again.
"Monsieur, John has just been to say that your agent has called and wishes to see you."
"Ah, in that case I must abridge. Opening the window, I walked in upon them, liberated Celine from my protection, gave her notice to vacate her hotel, offered her a purse for immediate exigencies, disregarded screams, hysterics, prayers, protestations, convulsions, made an appointment with the Vicomte for a meeting at the Bois de Boulogne. Next morning I had the pleasure of encountering him, left a bullet in one of his poor etiolated arms, feeble as the wing of a chicken in the pip, and then thought I had done with the whole crew. But unluckily, the Varenne, 6 months before, had given me this fillette, Adèle, who, she affirmed, was my daughter. And perhaps she may be, though I see no proofs of such grim paternity written in her countenance. Pilate is more like me than she. Some years after I had broken with the mother, she abandoned her child, and ran away to Italy with a musician or singer. I acknowledged no natural claim on Adèle's part to be more supported by me, nor do I now acknowledge any, for I am not her father. But hearing that she was quite destitute, I e'en took the poor thing out of the slime and mud of Paris, and transplanted it here, to grow up clean in the wholesome soil of an English country garden. Mrs. Fairfax found you to train it. But now you know that it is the illegitimate offspring of a French opera girl, you will perhaps think differently of your post and protégé. You will be coming to me some day with notice that you have found another place, that you beg me to look out for a new governess, etc. Eh?
No. Adèle is not answerable for either her mother's faults or yours. I have a regard for her, and now that I know she is, in a sense, parentless, forsaken by her mother and disowned by you, sir, I shall cling closer to her than before. How could I possibly prefer the spoilt pet of a wealthy family who would hate her governess as a nuisance to a lonely little orphan who leans towards her as a friend?
Oh, that is the light in which you view it. Well, I must go in now, and you too. It darkens.
But I stayed out a few minutes longer with Adèle and Pilate, ran a race with her, and played a game of battledore and shuttlecock. When we went in, and I had removed her bonnet and coat, I took her on my knee, kept her there an hour, allowing her to prattle as she liked, nor rebuking even some little freedoms and trivialities into which she was apt to stray when much noticed, and which betrayed in her a superficiality of character, inherited probably from her mother, hardly congenial to an English mind. Still, she had her merits, and I was disposed to appreciate all that was good in her to the utmost. I sought in her countenance and features a likeness to Mr. Rochester, but found none. No trait, no turn of expression announced relationship. It was a pity. If she could but have been proved to resemble him, he would have thought more of her. It was not till after I had withdrawn to my own chamber for the night that I steadily reviewed the tale Mr. Rochester had told me. As he had said, there was probably nothing at all extraordinary in the substance of the narrative itself. A wealthy Englishman's passion for a French dancer, and her treachery to him, were everyday matters enough, no doubt, in society. But there was something decidedly strange in the paroxysm of emotion which had suddenly seized him when he was in the act of expressing the present contentment of his mood, and his newly revived pleasure in the old hall and its environs. I meditated wonderingly on this incident, but gradually quitting it, as I found it for the present inexplicable, I turned to the consideration of my master's manner to myself. The confidence he had thought fit to repose in me seemed a tribute to my discretion. I regarded and accepted it as such. His deportment had now, for some weeks, been more uniform towards me than at the first. I never seemed in his way. He did not take fits of chilling hauteur. When he met me unexpectedly, the encounter seemed welcome. He had always a word and sometimes a smile for me. When summoned by formal invitation to his presence, I was honoured by a cordiality of reception that made me feel I really possessed the power to amuse him, and that these evening conferences were sought as much for his pleasure as for my benefit. I indeed talked comparatively little, but I heard him talk with relish. It was his nature to be communicative. He liked to open to a mind unacquainted with the world glimpses of its scenes and ways. I do not mean its corrupt scenes and wicked ways, but such as derived their interest from the great scale on which they were acted, the strange novelty by which they were characterized. And I had a keen delight in receiving the new ideas he offered, in imagining the new pictures he portrayed, and following him in thought through the new regions he disclosed, never startled or troubled by one noxious allusion. The ease of his manner freed me from painful restraint. The friendly frankness, as correct as cordial, with which he treated me, drew me to him. I felt at times as if he were my relation rather than my master. Yet he was imperious sometimes still. But I did not mind that. I saw it was his way. So happy, so gratified did I become with this new interest added to life, that I ceased to pine after kindred. My thin, crescent destiny seemed to enlarge. The blanks of existence were filled up. My bodily health improved. I gathered flesh and strength. And was Mr. Rochester now ugly in my eyes? No, reader. Gratitude and many associations, all pleasurable and genial, made his face the object I best liked to see. His presence in a room was more cheering than the brightest fire. Yet I had not forgotten his faults. Indeed, I could not, for he brought them frequently before me. He was proud, sardonic, harsh to inferiority of every description. In my secret soul I knew that his great kindness to me was balanced by unjust severity to many others. He was moody, too, unaccountably so. I more than once, when sent for to read to him, found him sitting in his library alone, with his head bent on his folded arms, and when he looked up, a morose, almost a malignant scowl blackened his features. But I believed that his moodiness, his harshness, and his former faults of morality—I say former, for now he seemed corrected of them—had their source in some cruel cross of fate. I believed he was naturally a man of better tendencies, higher principles, and purer taste than such as circumstances had developed, education instilled, or destiny encouraged. I thought there were excellent materials in him, though for the present they hung together somewhat spoiled and tangled. I cannot deny that I grieved for his grief, whatever that was, and would have given much to assuage it. Though I had now extinguished my candle and was laid down in bed, I could not sleep for thinking of his look when he paused in the avenue, and told how his destiny had risen up before him, and dared him to be happy at Thornfield. "Why not?" I asked myself. "What alienates him from the house? Will he leave it again soon? Mrs. Fairfax said he seldom stayed here longer than a fortnight at a time, and he's now been resident 8 weeks. If he does go, the change will be doleful. Suppose he should be absent spring, summer, and autumn? How joyless sunshine and fine days will seem!" I hardly know whether I had slept or not after this musing. At any rate, I started wide awake on hearing a vague murmur, peculiar and lugubrious, which sounded, I thought, just above me. I wished I had kept my candle burning. The night was drearily dark. My spirits were depressed. I rose and sat up in bed, listening. The sound was hushed. I tried again to sleep, but my heart beat anxiously. My inward tranquillity was broken. The clock, far down in the hall, struck two. Just then it seemed my chamber door was touched, as if fingers had swept the panels in groping away along the dark gallery outside. I said, "Who is there?" Nothing answered. I was chilled with fear. All at once I remembered that it might be Pilot, who, when the kitchen door chanced to be left open, not unfrequently found his way up to the threshold of Mr. Rochester's chamber. I had seen him lying there myself in the mornings. The idea calmed me somewhat. I lay down. Silence composes the nerves, and as an unbroken hush now reigned again through the whole house, I began to feel the return of slumber. But it was not fated that I should sleep that night. A dream had scarcely approached my ear when it fled affrighted, scared by a marrow-freezing incident enough. This was a demonic laugh, low, suppressed, and deep, uttered as it seemed at the very keyhole of my chamber door. The head of my bed was near the door, and I thought at first the goblin laugher stood at my bedside, or rather crouched by my pillow. But I rose, looked round, and could see nothing. While as I still gazed, the unnatural sound was reiterated, and I knew it came from behind the panels. My first impulse was to rise and fasten the bolt, my next again to cry out, "Who is there?" Something gurgled and moaned. Ere long, steps retreated up the gallery towards the third-story staircase. A door had lately been made to shut in that staircase. I heard it open and close, and all was still. "Was that Grace Poole? And is she possessed with a devil?" thought I. Impossible now to remain longer by myself. I must go to Mrs. Fairfax. I hurried on my frock and a shawl. I withdrew the bolt and opened the door with a trembling hand. There was a candle burning just outside and on the matting in the gallery. I was surprised at this circumstance, but still more was I amazed to perceive the air quite dim, as if filled with smoke. And while looking to the right hand and left to find whence these blue wreaths issued, I became further aware of a strong smell of burning. Something creaked. It was a door ajar, and that door was Mr. Rochester's, and the smoke rushed in a cloud from thence. I thought no more of Mrs. Fairfax. I thought no more of Grace Poole or the laugh. In an instant I was within the chamber. Tongues of flame darted round the bed. The curtains were on fire. In the midst of blaze and vapour, Mr. Rochester lay stretched motionless in deep sleep. "Wake! Wake!" I cried. I shook him, but he only murmured and turned. The smoke had stupefied him. Not one moment could be lost. The very sheets were kindling. I rushed to his basin and ewer. Fortunately, one was wide and the other deep, and both were filled with water. I heaved them up, deluged the bed and its occupant, flew back to my own room, brought my own water jug, baptized the couch afresh, and by God's aid succeeded in extinguishing the flames which were devouring it. The hiss of the quenched element, the breakage of a pitcher which I flung from my hand when I had emptied it, and above all the splash of the shower-bath I had liberally bestowed, roused Mr. Rochester at last. Though it was now dark, I knew he was awake, because I heard him fulminating strange anathemas at finding himself lying in a pool of water. "Is there a flood?" he cried. "No, sir," I answered. "But there has been a fire. Get up, do. You are quenched now. I will fetch you a candle."
"In the names of all the elves in Christendom, is that Jane Eyre?" he demanded. "What have you done with me, witch, sorceress? Who was in the room besides you? Have you plotted to drown me?"
"I will fetch you a candle, sir, and in heaven's name get up. Somebody has plotted something. You cannot too soon find out who and what it is."
"There, I am up now. But at your peril you fetch a candle yet. Wait 2 minutes till I get into some dry garments, if any dry there be. Yes, here is my dressing-gown. Now run!"
I did run. I brought the candle which still remained in the gallery. He took it from my hand, held it up, and surveyed the bed, all blackened and scorched, the sheets drenched, the carpet round, swimming in water.
"What is it? And who did it?" he asked.
I briefly related to him what had transpired, the strange laugh I had heard in the gallery, the step ascending to the third story, the smoke, the smell of fire which had conducted me to his room, in what state I had found matters there, and how I had deluged him with all the water I could lay hands on. He listened very gravely. His face, as I went on, expressed more concern than astonishment. He did not immediately speak when I had concluded. "Shall I call Mrs. Fairfax?" I asked.
"Mrs. Fairfax? No. What the deuce would you call her for? What can she do? Let her sleep unmolested."
Then I will fetch Leah, and wake John and his wife.
Not at all. Just be still. You have a shawl on. If you are not warm enough, you may take my cloak yonder. Wrap it about you and sit down in the armchair. There, I will put it on. Now place your feet on the stool to keep them out of the wet. I am going to leave you a few minutes. I shall take the candle. Remain where you are till I return. Be as still as a mouse. I must pay a visit to the second story. Don't move, remember, or call anyone.
He went. I watched the light withdraw. He passed up the gallery very softly, unclosed the staircase door with as little noise as possible, shut it after him, and the last ray vanished. I was left in total darkness. I listened for some noise, but heard nothing. A very long time elapsed. I grew weary. It was cold in spite of the cloak, and then I did not see the use of staying as I was not to rouse the house. I was at the point of risking Mr. Rochester's displeasure by disobeying his orders, when the light once more gleamed dimly on the gallery wall, and I heard his unshod feet tread the matting. I hope it is he, thought I, and not something worse. He re-entered, pale and very gloomy.
"I have found it all out," said he,
setting his candle down on the washstand.
"It is as I thought."
"How, sir?" He made no reply, but stood with his arms folded, looking at the ground. At the end of a few minutes he inquired in rather a peculiar tone,
"I forget whether you said you saw anything when you opened your chamber door."
"No, sir, only the candlestick on the ground."
"But you heard an odd laugh. You have heard that laugh before, I should think, or something like it."
"Yes, sir. There is a woman who sews here, called Grace Poole. She laughs in that way. She is a singular person."
"Just so. Grace Poole, you have guessed it. She is, as you say, singular. Very. Well, I shall reflect on the subject. Meantime, I am glad that you were the only person besides myself acquainted with the precise details of tonight's incident. You are no talking fool. Say nothing about it. I will account for this state of affairs," pointing to the bed, "and now return to your own room. I shall do very well on the sofa in the library for the rest of the night. It is near 4. In 2 hours the servants will be up."
"Good night, then, sir," said I, departing. He seemed surprised, very inconsistently so, as he had just told me to go.
"What?" he exclaimed. "Are you quitting me already, and in that way?"
"You said I might go, sir."
"But not without taking leave. Not without a word or two of acknowledgement and goodwill. Not, in short, in that brief, dry fashion. Why, you have saved my life, snatched me from a horrible and excruciating death, and you walk past me as if we were mutual strangers. At least shake hands."
He held out his hand. I gave him mine. He took it first in one, then in both his own.
"You have saved my life. I have a pleasure in owing you so immense a debt. I cannot say more. Nothing else that has being would have been tolerable to me in the character of creditor for such an obligation. But you, it is different. I feel your benefits no burden, Jane."
He paused, gazed at me. Words almost visible trembled on his lips, but his voice was checked. "Good night again, sir. There is no debt, benefit, burden, obligation in the case."
"I knew," he continued, "you would do me good in some way, at some time. I saw it in your eyes when I first beheld you. Their expression and smile did not—"
Again he stopped.
"Did not,"
he proceeded hastily,
"strike delight to my very inmost heart so for nothing. People talk of natural sympathies. I have heard of good genii. There are grains of truth in the wildest fable. My cherished preserver, good night."
Strange energy was in his voice, strange fire in his look. "I am glad I happened to be awake," I said, and then I was going.
"What? You will go?"
"I am cold, sir."
"Cold?" "Yes, and standing in a pool. Go then, Jane, go."
But still he retained my hand, and I could not free it. I bethought myself an expedient. "I think I hear Mrs. Fairfax move, sir," said I.
"Well, leave me."
He relaxed his fingers, and I was gone. I regained my couch, but never thought of sleep. Till morning dawned, I was tossed on a buoyant but unquiet sea, where billows of trouble rolled under surges of joy. I thought sometimes I saw beyond its wild waters a shore, sweet as the hills of Beulah, and now and then a freshening gale, wakened by hope, bore my spirit triumphantly towards the bourne. But I could not reach it, even in fancy. A counteracting breeze blew off land and continually drove me back. Sense would resist delirium, judgment would warn passion. Too feverish to rest, I rose as soon as day dawned.
So, Rochester.
What? Leave me? Now? Just when I've seen you in your nightdress?
Ah, Rochester. You kind of feel sorry for the guy. But you also, I think, are supposed to walk away respecting him. Now, this was a real tightrope walk that Charlotte put our Mr. Rochester on, because finally in this chapter, we get his full confession. We get his story about how he got Adele. And on the one hand, he is confessing
having had a relationship with a woman.
And not just any woman, but, you know, a woman who was on the boards, an actress, somebody who was in the theater, which is, of course, a really bad idea.
Which, you know, is not the best career move for a gentleman who's looking for a lifetime partner. And he certainly seems to have been completely taken with this woman. I mean, he set her up in her own place and all that stuff. But he got played for a fool. And so we're allowed to feel superior to him because of that.
At the same time, even though Adele is not his child, he rescued her. And so we can tisk-tisk at him for his behavior with the mother. But then we can say, oh, but he's a good man because he took the child. And so Charlotte, you know, really cleverly gave us a framework by which we could continue to like Rochester back when the book was originally released. It gave her audience a way to still respect him, even though he had made such a horrible, horrible, horrible mistake. Now, that's fine, but that goes straight back to stories that she wrote with Branwell. It could have been lifted from the pages of the journals that they created, because all of the men and women who were in their stories were debauched and murdered and ran away with somebody else's lover. And you have to look at when they were writing stuff like this, they couldn't possibly have known what they were talking about, really. Not really, when they were writing most of it. But here she is, grown up. Now she understands exactly what she's writing. But she still went back to these really familiar tropes. And on the one hand, it's very clever, because the rags, the magazines that were selling so many copies and were so popular, not Penny Dreadfuls, but, you know, step up from that, but not by much. Those were the really popular, like, People Magazine kind of things. But she was presenting Jane Eyre as a piece of literature, as a piece of, you know, real fiction literature, classy, bound in leather kind of book. That was a kind of a dangerous line to cross. And it's one of the places where she got criticized, just like Emily got criticized for, you know, why would you write a character like Heathcliff? What possible benefit to humanity could a character like Heathcliff give? So there's that element of Rochester that's going on. And then there's the laugh and Grace Poole and all of that stuff. Now, that I told you that the movies get something wrong. Every version of the movie that I've seen, and admittedly, I have not seen all of them. I've seen many. They all get this wrong. I don't know if it's because they're copying Orson Welles, or if it's because they simply feel the need to put something into Rochester's hands. But
correct me if I'm wrong, I've listened to this a bunch now, I've read it a couple times, Jane puts out the fire. The fire is out before Rochester wakes up, right? In the movies, it's Jane throws the water, begs him to wake up. She's trying to get more water. He finally gets out of bed. He tears down the curtains. He puts out the fire. Am I right? Is this just one of those things where they're like, in the movie, well, you couldn't, Jane can't put out the whole fire. She's just a little lady. Or is it one of those things that dramatically they just need to give Rochester something to do? I'm not sure. I'm not sure how it would play. But the other thing that I thought was interesting is in the William Hurt version, it seemed to me that he was very clearly drunk. And that's why he was asleep and had such a hard time waking up. In the story, it seemed to me that the point that Charlotte was making, or Jane Eyre was making, was that he was overwhelmed by the smoke already and really seriously would have died if she hadn't gotten in there when she did. Now, I find both of those things fascinating because to put the entire weight of rescuing Rochester's life on the diminutive shoulders of Jane Eyre was a pretty impressive thing for Charlotte to have done in one way, but in another way, kind of not. I mean, we think of these Victorian women as these, you know, little women. Oh, the little lady. And corsets, of course, made everything that much more difficult. Moving, breathing, things like that. But clearly, women back then, just like women today, had to shoulder plenty. And if your house is on fire, I'm gonna bet money that you will do whatever you have to do to get the fire out. So on the one hand, ooh, that's cool. Jane's a rock star. And on the other hand, I don't know why I should be surprised by that. And I don't know why the movie should have such a hard time showing it. But there it is. So things are certainly moving along with Mr. Rochester. I think we are probably safe in assuming that Jane's and Rochester's relationship has turned an interesting corner, and we'll see more about the two of them soon, like next week. I hope you have a great week. I hope you have a lovely time. I hope you enjoyed this chapter of Jane Eyre. This is one of those iconic chapters. You know, it's like, oh, it's the fire. So it's kind of fun to be able to play it for you. Take care of yourselves. I'll talk to you soon. There are many ways to listen to Craftlit. You can listen on your smartphone via the Stitcher Radio app. You can subscribe free through iTunes, or you can download and listen to the iPhone, iTouch, and Android app, where you'll receive occasional extras for the show. Craftlit is supported in a number of ways. Knit Circus, the free e-newsletter featuring three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at knitcircus.com. Also, the What Would Madame Defarge Knit series, Volume 2, What Else Would Madame Defarge Knit, is now in pre-orders. You can find out more from the links in the show notes at craftlit.com. Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories from the heart and home. And The Unique Sheep, home of the Gradients collection. Stand out from the flock. Visit theuniquesheep.com. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.